All right, so the title of my talk is the LDA plus the MFT approach to collated electron system. So this is a rather general title, and the very first part of my talk will also be more general, where I will introduce or recapitulate this approach which merges local density approximation and dynamical mean field theory. Antoine asked me to give a more technical talk and explaining some of the details of our calculation, and that's what is done in the second and in the third part of the talk. So in the second part, I will deal with the peculiarities to apply this LDA plus DMFT approach to transition metal oxides. I'll discuss some possible simplifications but also difficulties. So here I will, for example, compare a full Hamiltonian calculation to a simplified Hilbert transform calculation and discuss what the problems are for transition metal oxides when doing a full Hamiltonian LDA plus DMFT calculation. Then in the third part, I will discuss some of the technical details of our V2O3 calculation. So the work on V2O3 has been done in collaboration with Georg Keller, Volker Ayert, and Dieter Vollert from Augsburg, as well as with Vladimir Anisimov from Ekaterinburg. And I'd also like to advertise the second paper here, which is available on CompMed, or you can also get a copy from me now, which kind of gives an introduction to this method and also summarizes some of the early results. So besides V2O3, in particular on titanates, on also work of Andy McMahon and Richard Skeletor on cerium. I'd also like to invite you to take the more informal atmosphere of this workshop to ask questions or start a vivid discussion during the talk. And on the other hand, as Antoine asked me to give a more technical talk, so if you're not so interested in the technical aspects, if you're coming from another field or so, please feel free to go whenever you want to during the talk. Okay, so what is the LDA plus DMFT method? If you want to calculate some electronic properties of a solid state system, what you'd like to do is to solve the following Hamiltonian here, which is within Born-Oppenheimer approximation, the ab initio Hamiltonian for the electronic properties of a system. So we have the kinetic energies and we have fixed ion positions, and the ions give rise to one particle potential. And then we have the electron-electron interaction between two electrons at place or position r and r prime. Now, this is why all the difficulties arise. We have strong electronic correlations, and we can't solve this problem, and therefore we have to do some approximations. And one of the approximations is LDA, and another one which tries to improve on LDA is LDA plus DMFT. So in principle, LDA is based on the Hohenberg-Kohn theorem that says that the energy of this Hamiltonian is given as a functional on the density, and this allows us to put forward some Kohn-Cham equations to calculate the energy. Now, what one does in practice is to go one step beyond density functional theory, namely, one interprets some auxiliary Lagrange parameters as having really a physical meaning. That is, whenever you take an LDA band structure and compare it to experiment, then you take these parameters and say, well, this is really a physical quantity. And this second step is the same as replacing this interacting Hamiltonian by a one-particle Hamiltonian, where I have the same one-particle term, but now the electronic correlations are approximated by the Hartree term as well as by an exchange correlation potential. Of course, this is not exact, so there are some corrections here, and that is where all the electronic correlations are now. In an actual calculation, one expands in a basis, so these creation operators for an electron at position r are expanded in some basis set, creating an electron at a site I in some with some orbital indices L and M. And this transforms this LDA Hamiltonian into such a hopping Hamiltonian, where I have a general hopping between different sites and different orbitals. Now, the question is how to improve on this for electronic for strongly correlated electron systems like transition metal oxides or F electron systems. And there is an idea by Anisimov, Zanin, and Anderson, which they proposed in the context of their LDA plus U approach. And the idea is to take the LDA Hamiltonian from the last transparency as a starting point, and then to add the local Coulomb interaction. So whenever I have two electrons on the same side in different orbitals, but let's now restrict this interaction only on some particular orbitals, maybe the d orbitals in the transition metal oxides, then I have to pay a local Coulomb interaction term. Of course, part of this Hamiltonian is already contained within the LDA Hamiltonian, and I have to subtract this contribution of this Hamiltonian, which is in here, to avoid a double counting. And I'll come back later to what one can or approximately subtract here, for example, something like this. And of course, this is still not the full ab initio Born-Oppenheimer Hamiltonian, but there are some residual interactions not taken into account here. I'd like to make some comments. So why do we take the local Coulomb interaction? The reason for this is that if I have a Coulomb interaction between one side and neighboring sides, and I have many neighboring sides, let's say six or so, then in leading order to 1 over the number of neighboring sides, this nearest neighbor Coulomb interaction is just the Hartree term. So that's already contained in the LDA. There is no electronic correlations. Of course, if I have few neighbors, like in 1 or 2 dimensions, then I'll get a bigger correction here. Also, there's a need to identify the interacting orbitals, which can be done with the LMTO approach, for example. And also here now some parameters. So there's a Coulomb repulsion, but there's also a Hund-Sruck coupling. And this has to be calculated. And I'll come back to this calculation later in my talk. Now, this defines as a many-body, multi-band Hamiltonian, and we have different possibilities to solve it. We could use something like a flex approximation, or we could just use the Hartree-Fock, and then we arrive at the LDA plus U scheme, or we can use dynamical mean field theory, and then we have the LDA plus DMFT approach. So before I start with the more technical and detailed part of my talk, let me just shortly say what the DMFT is doing here for those not familiar with it, for those who are not familiar with it. So the LDA plus DMFT approach has been carried out for the first time by Vladimir Anisimov and co-workers. I think Sasha was one of the major co-workers here. And what is done in dynamical mean field theory is the following. On the last transparency, I had a lattice problem with one side coupling to neighboring sides. Now, if the number of neighboring sides goes to infinity, the central limit theorem tells us that fluctuations from side to side can be neglected, and I can replace the influence of all these sides by a mean influence. This gives rise to a single side problem of this one side here in a mean environment. And the single side problem is equivalent to a multiband Anderson impurity model, and it has to be solved self-consistently with the Dyson equation, or the K-integrated Dyson equation. And here is where all the interaction is, and this is also still a complicated many-body problem. And in the Dyson equation, there is where the LDA input is entering, namely the LDA band structure minus this double-counting correction. In my talk, I will employ quantum Monte Carlo simulations to solve this Anderson impurity model, and this has been done for the first time by Sascha Lichtenstein and Katznelson. I'd also like to point out that when one is doing, instead of this heavy numerical scheme, an approximative scheme, one can easier or cheaper arrive at some qualitative correct behavior, but quantitatively, these perturbation theories around strong coupling and around weak coupling will have some shortcomings, in particular if you're at intermediate coupling, for example, close to mod transition. So this was just to have everybody or to the recapitulation of LDA plus DMFT. And now I come to the more technical part of my talk. And here I would first like to discuss some of the difficulties, but also possible simplifications which arise if you deal with transition metal oxides. And the first thing I'd like to discuss is how to calculate these parameters, the Coulomb repulsion U, the Hunsrud exchange J, and also the double counting correction. And here, on the first transparency, I have something which I'd call the standard approach back to Anisimov, Tsarnaev, and Andersen. And on the next transparency, I will then discuss some of the difficulties if one is doing this. The problem is, if you do LDA, you don't know what LDA is doing with the local Coulomb interaction term. LDA is not a perturbative scheme, and therefore you just don't know what it's doing with it. And what Anisimov then suggested is to consider the atomic limit of this local Coulomb interaction. And in the atomic limit, I have a Coulomb, a mean Coulomb interaction U bar between every electron and everybody else except for itself. And then there's the exchange coupling, reducing the energy if I have two electrons with the same spin. Now, I know what this atomic limit contribution is. I don't know what the LDA energy for this local Coulomb interaction is. But now, I just assume that with an LDA, I just have this atomic limit contribution. And then I can, with this assumption or this approximation, I can calculate the double counting correction. Namely, the corrected one particle level is just the LDA one particle level, which is the derivative of the LDA energy with respect to the number of electrons in this orbital, which is just this. But then there is a correction. I have to subtract that part, which I will later on take into account as a local Coulomb interaction. And for this correction, I now take this energy, and then I arrive at this double counting correction. Yeah?
Just one question on this. If I remember correctly, this double counting scheme is actually not, just historically, not the one that was first suggested in the LDA plus U context, right?
They didn't have this J there. No, is that what you?
No, even independently of J, they actually had N minus the average value, all occupied being uniform, all orbitals being uniformly occupied, right? So that came a little bit later.
Yeah,
and okay, history.
So
doesn't
there, they.
History doesn't
yeah, okay, so.
I had a
okay.
Is it sort of known at this stage when one of the two schemes is better?
So this original one then rather corresponds to a Hartree-like atomic limit. So instead of the atomic... So the first one is taking Hartree-Fock here instead of the atomic limit, basically? Yeah, so...
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So. Okay. I think that okay. That is what we used for LDA plus DMFT, and I think in this context there isn't a thorough comparison yet of different schemes doing this, and which might be very much worthwhile.
Like Mazina in the workshop, and was sort of saying that this was better for insulator and the other scheme was better for metals. And he actually suggested something which was interpolating between the two. You may want to.
I see. Yeah. Okay, but you can think that if this is the atomic limit energy, the other is the Hartree-Fock, that one is better for metal and the other is better for an insulator. Now, so the first derivative here gives us a double counting correction. And if we take the second derivative with respect to the number of d electrons, then we can calculate the average Coulomb interaction and the Hund-Sruhl exchange. The second derivative, so the first derivative gives us the something like the LDA levels. And now if I take the difference between two LDA levels, that's something like the second derivative, but now as a finite differential quotient. And what is done to obtain u bar employing this formula is to take one occupation for up and down electrons, and then to remove one electron, and to take the difference for the same level between the two of them. And as you can see here, if you plug it in, or also just as this couples to the total number of electrons, if you remove one electron, then this will affect your energies. And with this finite differential quotient, you will get the u bar. And there's another differential quotient to obtain the exchange coupling J. And that is taking the difference between the up electron level and the down electron level, where the two of them are not equally occupied. So then this term comes into life and gives you a J as a difference. However, well, this might well work for F electron systems. And for F electron systems, you rather know very well or pretty well what is your F electron orbital, whereas for transition metal oxides, they hybridize with the D orbitals, hybridize with the oxygen, and you don't really know what are these orbitals. And therefore, you have large uncertainties in defining the orbitals and in defining the U bar, which is very sensitive on screening. So depending on the basis, depending on whether you're doing an orthogonalization when obtaining U bar, you get uncertainties, let's say, of 0.5 eV or even up to 1 eV. So this leaves us in a situation that most calculations so far for transition metal oxides regard this parameter as an adjustable parameter because an ab initio calculation has too much uncertainty. But there's also a problem with the Hund-Sruhl coupling. And that I only become aware of this summer, and maybe we could take the opportunity to discuss this during this workshop. The above formula I've shown you on the last transparency for the Hund-Sruhl coupling is for the following Hamiltonian. You have a U-bar coupling to the number of d electrons, and you have the Hund-Sruhl exchange, which is reducing the energy if you have two electrons in the same orbital. But this Hamiltonian is not what nature is, and it's also not what you will later do in the LDA plus DMFT calculation. In the LDA plus DMFT calculation, you will have a different U if you have two electrons in the same orbital, but you have a U prime, which is smaller than U by two times the Hund-Sruhl exchange, if the two electrons are in different orbitals. You don't have such an orbital average Coulomb repulsion, but you have a Coulomb repulsion for electrons in the same orbital, and a U prime if the two electrons are in different orbitals. And then you have, of course, also the Hund-Sruhl exchange. So depending on whether the spins are aligned in parallel or not, you have to pay the, or you gain the Hund-Sruhl exchange J. And there's also a spin flip term, which I will neglect here in my talk. Now, what does it mean? So let's take as an example V2O3, where we have two electrons in three T2G orbitals. So we have three orbitals, we have two electrons. And now what the LDA, or the constrained LDA calculation is doing, takes the energy of, let's say, a configuration where one up electron and one down electron, and takes the difference to the energy where I have no down electron and two up electrons. And here for Hamiltonian 1, this will just give rise to the exchange J. However, this is not the Hamiltonian we will later on deal with. Here, if you take this Hamiltonian, and if you take this configuration here, the first configuration, then you have to average. So you have U, but you also have U bar as an U prime as an interaction. Now, if you polarize the system, there is no U anymore. There are no two electrons in the same orbital because they are spin aligned. So if you now average, instead of U and U prime, you only have U prime. So you also get Coulomb repulsion energy. And altogether, this makes 4 over 3 times J instead of J as the energy difference. And here, this next line is why all of this consideration started. So if you take V2O3 and if you do this constrained LDA calculation, you get for the Hund-Sruy exchange a value of 0.9 eV. Now, if you take the atomic line spectrum, you have another way to calculate J, at least for the atom. And so I spent 2 days during summer to go to the line spectrum and to calculate J, and this gives a much smaller value of, let's say, 0.7 eV. Now, of course, this is the atom, but if you take the atom and put it into a lattice, then the electron wave function will be more extended. If the electron wave function is more extended, you will expect that J is even smaller than this value. So in nature, you seem to have a much smaller value of J than from this constrained LDA calculation. And the reason for this is that the constrained LDA calculation is calculating the J with respect to this Hamiltonian, whereas nature is doing something like this Hamiltonian. So if you correct for this value of 0.9 eV by this factor of 3 over 4, then you arrive at a J which is in reasonable agreement with the experiment for the atom. So what I'd like to discuss here is what value of J should we take in future calculations, this, or this, and, yeah?
What is your conclusion? I think everything is fine, so you take Hamiltonian number 2, which is multiple.
Yeah, I think we wish, okay.
And this is what experiments measure. It's not measured J, it's measured some splitting. And as I understand, splitting is just...
Yeah, so we should rather take in the future calculation
so
Hamiltonian 2 and this.
Nine.
Yeah, that's also what I think. Yeah?
Okay, great.
Okay. Now, the good news is that it doesn't seem to matter so much, at least for our V2O3 calculation, and at least close to the Fermi level. So this is the spectrum for V2O3 with LDA plus DMFT QMC. This is the Fermi level. And what we did, we calculated these two values of J, 0.93 eV and 0.7 eV. And what we see here is that around the Fermi level, the spectrum isn't changing very much. But here, only the upper Hubbard band, it is going to a somewhat lower value, and that is because the Hubbard U is becoming smaller when I go to the smaller Hund-Sruy exchange and keep the average Coulomb interaction fixed. But around the Fermi energy, there's not so much of a difference. Okay, now I'd like to discuss another peculiarity of transition metal oxide and discuss that one can often do a simplified calculation, and later on I will compare the simplified calculation to a full Hamiltonian calculation. So this is the LDA spectrum for lanthanum titanate, and what we have here is oxygen bands, T2G orbitals, and EG orbitals. And what we see here is, if you're interested in the physics around the Fermi energy, almost all of the spectrum stems from the T2G orbitals. And these T2G orbitals are also well separated from the EG orbitals as well as from the oxygen orbitals. So the idea here is now to restrict ourselves to these orbitals around the Fermi energy, for example, by downfolding to a three-band Hamiltonian, for example, with Anderson's third generation MTO, and then to treat this problem. However, then an additional simplification arises if I have orbital degeneracy. For example, if I have cubic symmetry, like in calcium vanadate, or almost cubic symmetry, like in lanthanum titanate, then I have orbital degeneracy for these three t to g orbitals, which means the self-energy is a scalar times the unit matrix, as is the Green's function. Now, if this self-energy is just a scalar, then it's just like a shift of the frequency. So I can calculate the Green's function, the interacting Green's function, from the non-interacting Green's function at zero self-energy just by shifting omega by the self-energy. And since the non-interacting Green's function is just given by the Hilbert transform of the LDA density of states, I can just employ the LDA density of states here.
Rho zero
is the LDA density of states.
D partial density of states.
That is the T to G. Well, I will come. So I will discuss this for the V2O3 calculation in more detail.
Will you come back to transcendent TI equation?
No, this is just to show you that typical situation.
Two technical questions. If you want to answer later, answer later. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sure.
When does in the calculations that were done in say the past 3 years on transcendent TI3 on the simplified T2G model, there was not complete down. I mean, the downfolding was not really done, right?
Yeah.
It was done in the calculation in the usual second generation thing, and then the T2G orbital partial density was selected. So then there are two issues that I'd like to get an answer about. One is the normalization.
Okay, so then let's discuss it now. And I thought to discuss this thing just for V2O3, but we can also discuss this here now. If you do the downfolding procedure, you would rather arrive at the red density of states, right? And the red density of states from here to here, in other systems you even have a gap here, like in V2O3, will contain 3 times spin degeneracy, 6 electrons altogether.
So
what you should do to deal with this density of states calculation instead of the downfolded Hamiltonian is to take this projected density of states, cut out this part here, which is in the oxygen, and renormalize it that it gives you the 6 electrons which have to be here. And
so
that's what has been done.
So what has been done is to change the normalization by this small, not a very big factor, probably
it's
5%.
Yeah, exactly.
And also the other question is, depending on the I think you mentioned that before in the talk, I mean, depending on the choice of orbitals, of basis set, whether you choose orthogonal basis set or sprint basis set, the number of d electrons you are having is not it's not exactly one, right? And it can vary.
Well, within this approach, you adjust it to one because here in these orbitals you have an integer number.
Right.
So, if you go to this effective Hamiltonian in these effective bands, you will have one, and that is so you adjust. But in the I will come back to the full Hamiltonian calculation, whereas this is not exactly one.
Let me make sure I really understand. If you do the second say calculation with this second generation NTO kind of thing, you will calculate the ND and you will not find one, right?
You won't find exactly one.
Yeah,
that's
0.8.
True. But in this effective Hamiltonian, so if you really do the downfalling, you should have one.
No.
And therefore we took the density of states, rescaled it in practice, and
in practice what was done before is A, change the normalization of the density of states so that integrates to 6.
Yeah.
And B, change the location of the chemical potential so that you have strictly 1 d electron.
Yeah.
That's what we're
So the chemical potential was adjusted to have 1 d electron.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can I ask you a question? In all of these calculations, you don't have the spin orbital coupling in there, right?
People are thinking about doing spin orbit coupling now also in this context, but there hasn't been anything. No, that's not true. Savrasov Kotlia did spin orbit coupling for
plutonium.
Yeah, they did it already.
for this system is very important.
But here, I think for the transition metal oxides, the spin orbit coupling is likely not so important because the orbital momentum is screened and.
But for the low energy properties, low temperature properties, low energy properties.
Yeah. Okay. So for an F electron system, you rather have these localized orbitals and. Then the spin orbit coupling is stronger. But here now, if you put your ion into the lattice, then you have hybridization and quenching of the orbital momentum. So I think it is not so important. But and so people will first do spin orbit for F systems, of course. Okay. So the advantage is that we only need the T2G density of states from the LDA calculation here. And also the double counting correction becomes irrelevant because the double counting correction will shift all T2G orbitals by the same number. It's just a shift of the chemical potential, and then we will adjust the chemical potential to get the number of electrons correctly. And so it doesn't matter what the LDA double counting correction is. Now, if we don't have a perfect cubic symmetry, or if we have another lattice, like for example V2S3, the T2G orbitals aren't degenerate anymore. They still have very similar centers of gravity. And what we've done then in the V2S3 calculation is to employ the formula of the Lass transparency in an approximation where now the self-energy is not the same for the different orbitals, giving rise also to different Green's functions. So this neglects some interband hoppings in the downfolded Hamiltonian. And we will we are now also doing a downfolded Hamiltonian calculation to see what the effect of this is. Now, I'd like to show you what is happening if one is doing, instead of the simplified calculation, a full Hamiltonian calculation, which I'd like to call here naive because it doesn't work. So in the full Hamiltonian calculation, we took the full LDA Hamiltonian. The T2G orbitals were assumed to be interacting. But then there are also oxygen and EG orbitals taken as non-interacting. And we've done the calculation with the simplification with the LDA density of states and compared it to the full Hamiltonian calculation where you have the Dyson equation where the full LDA Hamiltonian with T2G oxygen and EG is entering. So the Coulomb parameters were the same here for both calculations. And what you see here is this is the imaginary part of the self-energy versus Matsubara frequency. And this is the calculation for the LDA density of states only. And this is the calculation with the full Hamiltonian. So the full Hamiltonian gives a solution which is not at all correlated. The self-energy is very small. And the reason for this is that this full Hamiltonian calculation, there you are very far away from the situation from a Mott insulator, because in the density of states calculation, we had 4 electrons. And in the full Hamiltonian calculation, we have 4.5 electrons in this interacting Hamiltonian. So you're very far away from the Mott insulator, and therefore your self-energy is so weakly correlated. So it doesn't work. Here's another example, lanthanum titanate. So these are, again, the parameters being the same for both calculations. And again, the full LDA calculation gives you the LDA calculation with the density of states only or the Hilbert transform gives you a reasonable self-energy. And the full Hamiltonian calculation gives you a 2 weakly correlated system. Again, that here we have another number of T2G electrons. So it fails. And the question is, of course, why does it fail? Here is a spectrum of strontium ruthenate with this full Hamiltonian calculation. So some of the orbitals are plotted. The green one here and the red one are the two of the T2G orbitals. And the blue and the purple one are oxygen orbitals. And the dark blue one is one of the EG orbitals. And what you see here, here is the Fermi level. But what you see here is part of the oxygen is not occupied. And that means that you have to have more than an integer number of electrons in the T2G orbitals. And that means that you have this 4.5 electrons here. And the question, yeah?
Is this a pure LDA calculation, or do you have the self-energy?
This is LDA plus DMFT QMC.
I thought
for pure LDA. Oh, I don't have it here with me.
I thought if you went to the at least towards the atomic limit, Hubbard 1 self-energy, for example, will pin the occupation of the correlated state to an integer.
This is, of course, if your interaction becomes very large, then you will have this integer occupation. But then you really have to take the much larger unscreened interaction, I think, for the T2G orbital, which is not the... So the I took here is the 4EV, which consists, which takes into account the screening due to the oxygen orbitals. Then you have something like 4 or 5 EV interaction. If you don't take the oxygen screening into account, you will have 8 or 10 EV for the interaction between the d orbitals. And I think that's what you have to do. So you have to do really a calculation with the full Hamiltonian, with the 3d and the oxygens being interacting. And if you have a 3d oxygen interaction, then you will also easily shift this oxygen somewhat downward, because then the oxygen interaction, the interaction between oxygen and d electrons, will tend to make your oxygen's orbitals integer occupied. So I think what you have to do is a full Hamiltonian calculation with a 8 or 10 EV interaction on the 3D orbitals plus the oxygen D interaction. But okay, yeah?
I think what you are saying depends on the regime of parameters you're in, because I definitely know that if you consider, let's consider a very simple model, just mm-hmm. say a two-bound model in which you have a correlated D orbital mm-hmm. and a non-correlated oxygen orbital.
Yeah.
And so there are two parameters. One is the on-site interaction on the D orbitals,
mm-hmm.
and the other one is Ep minus Ed, which is the charge transfer energy. Let me put U equal to zero on the oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be a completely uncorrelated oxygen. I know for sure, and this goes back, of course, to Zahn and Zawadzki Allen, but in the context of mm-hmm. DMFT, this was done many years ago, that if you take the U on the correlated orbitals to be big enough, mm-hmm. you're going to have a transition, I think, that connects to what Andy was saying, which is only driven by the ratio of the charge transfer energy to the TPD equalization.
Yeah, but okay, yeah.
So there is no question that this model is going to have multi-insulating states.
Yeah, but because we have this, we start with this non-integer occupation. You really have to have very large radius of U.
The partial occupancy of the d orbital at these insulating fillings will not be integer, of course. Only md plus mp
will be integer.
That works, and that works even if you put U equal to zero on the oxygens. This is what I want to say.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, what you have, the problem you have is that if you have two manifolds of the orbitals, which yeah. is the case here, like T2G and EG, you don't want to mess up in the Hamiltonian in such a way that the D electrons have an opportunity to go to populate the uncorrelated guy.
Yeah, but that's not just happening here, right? So the EG orbitals are still...
What is wrong here?
Yeah, right. I have the same question.
What is wrong here?
Sorry?
It's not UP equal to zero. You cannot put the blame on that. That's what I'm trying to say.
What What is wrong in this picture?
In this picture, it's wrong that you don't, well, that the electronic correlations aren't strong enough for, as they should be for such a Hubbard interaction U.
But you said use the unscreen U, right? Because you've got the oxygens in. You
that's
can't have the oxygen screening the U. That's what you're claiming.
Yeah, that's what I think, is that you have to take the larger value of U, and then automatically you have the oxygen D interaction, because otherwise you'd take the screened
U. I don't think that can be, because the criterion for the transition is UDD compared to something which is the...
Yeah, but if you take the UDD, the unscreened UDD, then you also should take into account the UDP, right?
That's what I'm trying to say.
Not in a model, but in a real-world calculation.
No, I think that even in a real-world calculation, I think the criterion is that the DD interaction should be compared to the bandwidth, which is mainly a PD bandwidth.
Mm-hmm. But then if you take the screened value of U, which is 4 or whatsoever EV, then it doesn't work.
I mean, what is the distance between the oxygens and the Ds?
I don't remember fully. So 3-4 EV.
It's the metal, the normalized metal.
So I understand. So you took 1 point whatsoever EV for the system, and you obtained a very similar spectrum for the T2G orbitals, right? Okay, but I think is that if you have the larger value of U, you should have more strongly correlated system. So this is not 1.2 EV Coulomb interaction. This is.
But did you estimate the Z factor? Maybe you have even more renormalizations in experiment. Experiment is about.
Well, the Z factor is just the less transparency, basically.
And how much is it?
Well, it's very, very small. And as you see here, this jump here of the first derivative is the z vector.
So what you could estimate in both cases?
Hmm?
Experimentally, it's about 3.
Okay, so I'd like to discuss this issue also maybe later on or after the talk of what one really has to do. Here, Sasha.
What kind of double count?
The one I introduced on the first transparency. Okay, now I'd like to come to the third part of my talk and the technical details on our V2O3 calculation. I think all of you know this phase diagram for V2O3, temperature versus pressure, experimentally chromium and titanium doping. And what I'm interested in is this first order isostructural transition between the paramagnetic insulator and the paramagnetic metal, which is the Mott Hubbard transition. Let me just very briefly discuss the basic electronic structure. So this is a coronium lattice structure where we have every vanadium ion surrounded by an this octahedron of oxygens, which leads us to a situation where we have at the Fermi energy two EG pi orbitals and one A1G orbital. And then with this basic consideration, Castellani, Natalie, and Runningham proposed that because we have a pair of vanadium ions here, which is assumed to be very strongly coupled by hybridization, that this hybridization here leads to splitting of this A1G orbital into a bonding and an antibonding orbital, and then that we have a spin singlet in the bonding orbital, which leaves us at a situation of one electron per side for the EG pi bands. Now, this works if the Hund-Sul coupling is really strong, about 0.2 eV or so. But Hund-Sul coupling is working against this because Hund-Sul coupling, if it's stronger, doesn't matter if it's a 0.7 or the 0.9 eV, which is the uncertainty or the difference I discussed at the beginning. Even at 0.5 eV, the Hund-Sul coupling will form a spin 1 on every side instead of this singlet here. And so that's what's happening here. And now I'd like to go through our calculation. So this is again maybe a nicer view graph of this lattice structure. So we have these pairs of vanadium. Here are shown the octahedra of oxygen around every vanadium ion. On the other hand, this pair is not so particular because the distance here is very similar to the pair distance. And what we took here is the crystallographic structure data of Dernier, which is for V2O3. The unit cell contains four vanadium ions and has a dimension in the XY plane of 5 angstrom and in the Z direction of about 14 angstrom. And what is happening if I dope the system with chromium is that the crystal shrinks in this direction a little bit and expands in this direction. But this shrinking and expansion is in such a way that all the distances to nearest vanadium ions are increasing. So this distance is increasing as well as this distance. And the shrinking in the Z direction is mainly because this gap here becomes smaller. Now, Anton asked me to discuss what kind of LDA calculation we used. So this is the augmented spherical wave LDA version 1.9. Volker Eier did the calculation. You can download even the documentation of this program from the internet. But I think it doesn't matter so much in this approach we used. What kind of LDA calculation is used. So our LDA calculation is in good agreement with the one done by Matai.
You simulated this chromium substitution by changing these A and C parameters.
Yeah. Okay. And also these internal parameters determining where the position of vanadium and oxygen is. So we didn't take into account any disorder effects or something like that. Only we took into account two different crystal structures. This is the result of the band structure calculation. So we have the EG orbitals and the T2G orbitals around the Fermi energy. And we see here they are rather well separated. And because we have four atoms in the unit cell, we have altogether 12 T2G bands. So these are 12 here. And what is indicated here by the gray bar are the contribution of the A1G orbitals. And what we see here is that in part of the baryon zone, we have something reminding of a bonding antibonding splitting. But in another part, there's no bonding antibonding splitting at all. So this bonding antibonding splitting is too simple here. But nonetheless, also it holds to some extent. So we will get something like a bonding band. So this is a spectral function, partial density of states for different orbitals. So this is the A1G orbital having some spectral contribution here, and more spectral contribution at the upper band edge. But in a bonding antibonding splitting, you would assume equal weights here, which is not the case. And this is a T2G density of states and the EG orbitals. Now,
in this partial density of states approximation, again, the partial density of states were adjusted. So
I'll come back to it.
Okay.
So we did the same band structure calculation without disorder due to chromium, but just taking into account the different lattice parameters. And this gives basically the same answer. So I can try to overlay the two of them to see whether there are any differences. And you see the differences are very small. So down here, you see that up in chromium doping, this A1G orbital is a little bit smaller. But also, if you chromium dope the system, then you only change the volume by less than 1.5%. And similarly, the band structure only changes by less than, let's say, 2% or so. Now, this was the LDA calculation. Now, the question is, the next step to do is to make to supplement the LDA calculation with the local correlation, so to arrive at a multi-band, many-body problem. And there are several ways to do this. So first, you could take this V2O3 unit cell with four vanadium ions, take all the oxygen into account, and then you arrive at 76 interacting orbitals. So this is something which you can't do, at least not currently, maybe in 10 years or so. Then you could think of neglecting the interaction of the to the oxygen and to take only the interaction of the T2Gs into account, but keeping the four vanadium ions per unit cell so that your DMFT cell has four vanadium atoms and all the other DMFT cells coupling to that too. Then you arrive at 24 interacting orbitals, which might be manageable in a more near future. Or you could use only a vanadium pair. And because of this particular importance of the vanadium pair, and to take also only into account the T2G orbitals downfalling to an effective Hamiltonian, then you have 12 interacting orbitals. And that's what, as I understand it, Sasha and Sasha are currently trying to do. Or what we have done is we went to a single site DMFT with one vanadium atom in our DMFT cell, and then you have three T2G orbitals times two for the spin degeneracy makes six interacting orbitals altogether, and that's what we've done here. But you could also think of doing an effective Hamiltonian calculation by taking into account the T2G orbitals plus oxygen of the same T2G symmetry. Then, well, they're different. So as soon as you arrive at these effective Hamiltonians, you have many possibilities.
You're considering only on-site interaction.
Only on-site interaction, yeah. Okay, but if you take into account oxygen, you would, of course, have... okay, let's discuss this later, whether it's necessary. If you have the PD interaction, then it wouldn't be on-site. So what we did is we took the partial densities of states for the EG sigma and for the A1G band and cut off those contributions which are in the oxygen bands and randomized the densities of states to 1. This defines as a LDA Hamiltonian, and then we supplemented it with the local Coulomb interaction U and a U prime for the interaction between different orbitals. And we took the Hunsrück exchange coupling as given by this constrained LDA calculation by Soloviev. Okay, this is still a larger value for the Hunsrück exchange, as I discussed in the second part of my talk. Maybe one has to use a lower value here. Okay, I will discuss below how we arrived at U, but if you have the U, then you can calculate the U prime.
May I ask another question about density states? If you had integrated the full EG density of states, partial density of states, you would have gotten an integer, right? From minus infinity to plus infinity.
Yeah, sure.
So is it what's bothering you that the big lump of it is over by the oxygens and you're not going to take the oxygens into account?
Well,
you're reluctant to have that in the calculation. Is that the
idea? Well, I think this is... So the next step we will do is a downfolding Hamiltonian for this V2O3 system. And I think, so in the downfalling, you only have the orbitals at the Fermi energy. You don't have these wiggles of the T2G in the oxygen. And so I think this is more of the physical situation if you try to deal with the low energy physics. When you have...
I understood your logic correctly, though, that you had this bit of oxygen way out here. You weren't putting in the oxygen. I mean, it was D stuff, but it was echoing in the oxygen band.
Yeah.
You weren't going to put in the oxygen bands you wanted.
Yeah. Okay. And so then the next step is doing a DMFT calculation with this three-band Hamiltonian using quantum Monte Carlo simulations to solve it. So we choose an initial self-energy, for example, from a calculation of a similar value for the Coulomb interaction U. And then we have this Dyson equation, as I already showed on one of the previous transparencies, Brahms' Dyson equation, we get the Green's function out of the self-energy. Then we can define a DMFT field, curly G, which defines a single side problem. The single side problem contains all of the interaction. The Dyson equation contains all of the LDA information. Then we do the DMFT single side problem with quantum Monte Carlo simulations employing throttle discretization of 0.25 eV to the minus 1 with the new Green's function. And this difference, we get a new self energy and iterate till self convergence. And convergence means that in a sum norm, we have something like 10 to the minus 4 difference or mean difference between the old and the new self energy. Now, how did we adjust the U here? We adjusted it in a very particular way, namely, we did two calculations, one for chromium doped V2O3 and one for metallic V2O3. So chromium doped V2O3 is insulating. And of course, as you have seen, LDA doesn't give you the correct answer. With an LDA, both are metals. Now, we took different values of U and did the calculation for both kinds of systems. And at a small value of U, both give you a metallic answer. At a large value of U, both give you an insulating answer. And in between, you are at the situation that red and green, that is V2O3, are still metallic, whereas black and blue are already insulating. So we took this value of 5 eV. Of course, there's some room. So it's, so 5 eV is an integer value at what we took. You could also take 5.05 eV or so. But if you take 5.1 eV, it's already too much.
And, okay, maybe I should keep this question for the end. But basically, the fact that it is so sensitive to the value of U that you are putting in is presumably due to the fact that this is a density of states calculation. And we've seen before, you showed us two density of states at the LDA level are very, very similar. Right? So one has to be poised, right? At that value of U, where one would be insulating, the other one
would be. Yeah, so the difference in the density of states was 2% or so.
Right.
That means that also you can't have more difference in U.
So in reality, do you expect, okay, so do you expect this to be indeed the mechanism, or do you expect that these two systems in fact differ by structural aspects that are not showing up just in the electronic density of states?
Well, I think that this is the mechanism, but okay, we didn't have taken into account any effect of disorder, so due to the chromium, which might get some kind of different structure, but also the chromium doping is not so big, so it's less than 4%.
Well,
so
disorder may not be the point, but more distortions.
Well, we took into account, so it's the same crystal structure. At least if I believe in Dernier's crystallographic work. So we took into account the correct crystal structures of the two systems. So there is nothing else there, at least not that I know of. OK, so this is just to show you, this is the higher temperature. So if you go to lower temperature, you clearly see that one solution, so this is the V2O3 calculation for the EG pi band and for the A1G band, and you have a clear quasi-particle which is already gone for the insulating. So here at 5 eV you really have the metal insulator transition. Maybe I should take the opportunity to briefly discuss here what is going on. So we have two densities of states. One is the EG pi density of states, which might be more or less something like a semicircle. And then we have the A1G density of states, which is more something like this. So there's maxima at the band edge. Now, what is happening if you take into account electronic correlations? So you will have a spin one system. And then, so let's have here the Fermi level. And then you will have a lower Hubbard band for these So I'd like to discuss only the insulator here. So for the EG pi band, you will have a lower Hubbard band, which is, let's say, occupied by something like 1/3/4 electrons. So most of the electrons are in the EG pi band. And then you also have a lower Hubbard band for the A1G band. But there's only a tiny contribution of 1/4 electrons per side in the A1G bands. So if you have the situation, now if you add an electron in the EG pi band, then you have to pay the Hubbard U, which is 5 eV. So the upper Hubbard band for the EG pi band will be about 5 eV above the lower Hubbard band in the insulating phase. But if you add an electron in the A1G orbitals, you don't have to pay U because your main occupation is for the EG pi orbitals. So you only have to pay the U prime, or you can even have a spin polarization, so you only have to pay U prime minus J. So for the A1G, you will have U prime or even U prime minus J, which is 2.2 to 3.3 eV only. So there will be the other band. And because of this band having its maxima at the band edges, you will really have a contribution here of the A1G band very close to the Fermi energy. And you don't have a big gap here in the system. So that's what's happening here. So this is the insulator, the blue and the black one, so you have the lower Hubbard band. And at about 5 eV above the lower Hubbard band, you have the upper Hubbard band for the EG pi band. And then your A1G density of states only has a small contribution here, and a splitted contribution here, which is very close to the Fermi energy. And of course, because you have two different U's, and in the insulator, you will have an additional splitting here of this. So that is what is happening here. Okay, so I'm running out of time. So let's just mention here that the effect of temperature was surprisingly big. So this is going from 1,000 Kelvin to 300 Kelvin. So doing the 1,000 Kelvin calculation, we thought so that's more or less a spectrum. It won't change so much. But actually, the quasi-particle peak becomes much sharper. We know this already from a single impurity Anderson model. If you go from such a spectrum and increase temperature and are above the Kondo temperature will be something like the width here, then at some point, you will smear this resonance out. But the point where you smear it out is at T Kondo over log T Kondo or something like that. So it's at a higher temperature than the width here. Here, this peak is already smeared out at a temperature which is comparable, but still lower than the width. So the effect is much bigger. And this is, of course, due to having the dynamical mean field theory here, where our single impurity model, or our auxiliary single impurity model of DMFT, will change with temperature. Okay, so finally, I'd like to compare this calculation to experiment. So here are different spectra below and above the Fermi energy. The dotted lines are the LDA result. And the red line is our LDA plus DMFT QMC calculation. And the symbols are different experiments. And what we see here is that we have a spectrum very different from LDA. And it gives about the correct width below and above the Fermi energy when compared to experiment.
Is that
room
temperature here?
This temperature is the 1,000 Kelvin, but I'll come to the 300 room temperature calculation later. The experiments are at different temperatures. So the latest photo emission I will show on the next transparency is at 170 or so Kelvin, whereas the calculation is at room temperature. But that's the next transparency.
You're comparing calculations and experiments at the same temperature.
At different temperatures. That's at different temperatures.
Why are you?
Because in the calculation, what we can do is room temperature now. So we had a really big struggle to go to room temperature and say, here with these experiments, I'm not sure. They might also be room temperature. But then there are latest developments in the photo emission spectroscopy. And they were done, unfortunately, not at room temperature, but at lower temperatures. So it's not the numerical effort just draws cubic with the inverse temperature.
I mean, these spectra are very temperature dependent.
So yeah. So and we will soon have very different. I'll show you this on the next transparency, the latest comparison here. What won't change are some of the general features. Well, we have to smooth the spectrum with the experimental resolution. The experimental resolution here is very bad, so there won't be such a big difference with temperature. With the temperature, the peak becomes sharper, but the weight is changing a little bit, not so much. But okay, these are, of course, things to discuss. But what won't change is that we have the correct width here and the correct width there, because the width wasn't changing with temperature. And what also won't change is that we have a kind of two or three peak, maybe, structure here. And our two peak structure here is very different from the LDA two peak structure. So in the LDA, we have this first peak here being due to the T2G orbitals, whereas in our calculations, this is only the A1G orbital contributing here. Then LDA has a second peak here at about the same thing as the experiment. But our calculation is saying this is actually the EG pi orbital, and the EG sigma orbitals are at a larger energy. So we recently did a calculation where we took these orbitals into account by using the Hartree approximation for the interaction to these orbitals, and then they will be up here. So these general features won't change. But what, of course, will or might change with temperature is how sharp this peak is, right? So we have some general features which are correctly described. And here, I'd like to change how recently some improvements in the experiment changed the spectrum drastically. So this is now a new spectrum by Moore et al., which is more bulk sensitive because it uses higher photon energies. And another important improvement was that the photo emission beam spot was decreased considerably to 100 micrometer in diameter. And then the photo emission spectrum doesn't look very correlated at all. So we have a very broad peak here. So this is 175 Kelvin. And we compared it to our 300 Kelvin calculation. And we see why we get about the correct position of the Hubble band and the width. The weight of this peak here is very different. And I wouldn't pay so much attention whether it's becoming even a little bit sharper if I decrease temperature. But the difference is already that in experiment, this quasi-particle peak has a bigger weight than in our theory. So there are some differences which won't be canceled if we would go in our calculation to 175 Kelvin instead of 300 Kelvin. So here we took into account the experimental broadening of 0.09 eV with a Gaussian broadening function.
Well, maybe I should just mention at this stage that Jim Allen, who was here earlier, will also be here next week.
So he will, sure.
You, the whole experiment,
he will give much more details on this. Right. Okay, so I'd like to conclude or also to put forward some questions. So So the first point concerned how to deal with the U and the J for transition metal oxides. And of course, we would like to have a better way than to adjust U for a transition metal oxide calculation. But this is rather difficult, in particular for a calculation which so sensitively depends on U when we are close to a MOT transition. So what to do with the Hund's rule J? So far, the calculation have been done mainly with this constrained LDA calculation, which gave radius of J of about, let's say, 0.9 eV or so for transition metal oxide. So shall we rather use a modified calculation for the J in the future? I've also discussed some of the problems for the full Hamiltonian approach, and I'd be happy to discuss this here during the workshop. Then I've shown you not a full Hamiltonian calculation, but a calculation restricting to the T2G bands and dealing with two densities of states for V2O3, which works pretty well, giving overall the correct results. But there are also differences, in particular regarding the weight of this quasi-particle peak. And the question is, of course, what is the reason for this? Is this this vanadium pair, which is a very favorable candidate by some, and other people say it's not so important, but I think we will learn on that in the near future. Then another question I have is, if I look at the photoemission spectrum and with my theoretical background, this looks so uncorrelated, or it doesn't look uncorrelated, but it doesn't look to be on the verge of a metal insulated transition. I have a broad quasi-particle peak, and I don't understand how I can be so close to a transition with only structural changes of 0.5% and still so far away in the spectrum from the metal insulated transition. Another question is, what is the origin of the first-order transition in V2O3? Is there a first-order transition due to crystal changes, and because of this first-order transition, we get a MOT transition? Or is the MOT transition causing the first-order transition? And there can be two reasons why the MOT transition is causing a first-order transition. First of all, if we consider the Hubbard model, and if you go to very low temperatures, then there are two coexisting solutions, and we have a first-order transition between the two of them. So this could cause the first-order transition. But personally, I think this doesn't matter at all whether I have two solutions or not, that there's a much bigger effect, namely that when the quasi-particle weight goes to zero, this gives a contribution to the correlation energy, which is concave. And because of this, I have something like a van der Waals thermodynamic instability, like between liquid and vapor phases. And this gives a first-order transition. And Andy will tell next week about the calculation on cerium. He did, and there it is actually the case that this was already calculated by taking the energy for different volumes, and for cerium, this is the reason, at least within this, it looks like within this LDA plus DMFT calculation for the first order transition. And so I think that it should, or so my expectation is that it's also the reason for V2O3. So thank you very much for your attention. Yeah.
Can you get coexistence of solutions within the LDA?
Not down to the temperature, 300 K. Well, at
300 Kelvin combination will be how large in terms of the bandwidth?
The temperature?
Yes.
Okay, the bandwidth is about 2. So 300 is 0.03 of 0.01 or so. But okay, I should maybe also say that what we did so far, we didn't start from the insulating solution fully yet. So we went from the metallic solution and didn't see any indication of the first order transition yet. But we, the work is still in progress. We also have to go from the chromium doped phase and to decrease the U a little bit. And there we are still, or Georg Keller is now doing calculations on that. So. But we didn't have a jump yet in the metallic phase. Yeah?
How many sweeps do you do in the
Something like 10 to the 5, so.
Thank you.
Yeah. Can I ask for an overview for a naive outsider? So, as experiments get better, V2O3 looks less and less correlated, whereas your calculation, you're working hard to put the correlations in. What is the resolution of that in your mind?
Well, there is a difference that the experiment looks less correlated than our theoretical calculation, and maybe there is a physical origin of this difference. Like, for example, the correlations due to the pair where you have the neighbors, which are not taken into account in the calculation yet, but. This has to be resolved yet.
I'm a little bit confused because when Jim visited here, like maybe a month and a half ago, he gave us the impression that there was a lot more of a narrow quasi-particle peak than what his earlier experiments seemed to suggest.
Yeah. So well, so here you can basically compare that. There is a peak. So before, so his earlier photo emission experiment was something like this,
right.
And now there is a peak, but the peak is broad. So this is much more correlated than this, right? So this is now just a sketch but now the spectrum looks like this, and before the spectrum looked like this, and this is more correlated than that. But you really have a peak now, which I can also show if I find that.
This looks more like the PMSC picture, and the other one does not,
because this. Well, the shoulder one, not so well resolved. Pictures also DMFT if you're close to a Mohr transition at higher temperature.
Very large temperature. So that's the burn question. The reason why previously you had some reasonable agreement with the former experiment is because you compared the spectra with a 1000 Kelvin calculation, right?
Yeah, but also if you go to lower temperatures and then again closer to the Mohr transition, you will again have rather such a spectrum, right? So,
this is
either at higher temperature and more a little bit more apart from the mod instance. So what is happening? If in the one particle model, you have something like this, and then you have something like this closer to the mod transition with these additional wiggles, and here you also have these different bands,
right.
So that I think so if you're closer to the Mohr transition, your quasi-particle weight, either if you are either due to temperature or going closer to the Mohr transition at the same temperature, you will go from here to the sphere.
Yeah, but what I'm trying to say is that within the MFT, the way the metal disappears as it gets more and more correlated is by having a narrowing of this peak, right?
Yeah, but at some temperature, the height will disappear or go down.
So in that sense, the latest experimental spectra are not sure to that as a first approximation.
Yeah, let's hear. So this is actually the Schmidt R, the green one. Is the first experiment by Jim Allen, and this is the improved one.
The other experiment is sort of gone now. I mean, it's very different from that anyway.
Yeah.
So,
pretty much. No, this is just a spectrum. So here I assume that there. This is of course another problem. So this is the experimental intensity using, so only with sudden approximation, neglecting any frequency dependence of the matrix elements, etc. This will become the spectrum.
What I'm trying to say is very naive. It's just that if you go to a DMST calculation, which is a little less correlated than what you have on the black curve here, you probably get a much better agreement with the experimental spectrum.
But then we don't get the insulator anymore.
Well, that's another problem.
No, I think it's well. We shouldn't play around too much. So I was very happy that we have this way of fixing the value of u.
Don't you think it's more reasonable to get to good agreement with the experiment by saying, well, this system is a little less correlated than what we thought, than by putting 1,000 Kelvin where the experiment is at 300 Kelvin? This is sort of more reassuring for what you are doing, I think.
No, we are not trying to adjust anything to the experiment. So we weren't aware at the beginning that changing temperature was such a big effect, because we estimated the width of the peaks, etc. And then we saw, okay, temperature is smaller than the width. So from the quantum or Anderson purity model, we thought there's not so much difference in changing the temperature to lower temperatures.
What is the effective mass for experimentally measure the effective mass for that compound,
so I think it's something like 3 or so.
The mass enhancement is a factor of 3?
Yeah.
Well, your Z factor in the black curve is going to be what?
So the Z factor will be, let's say, 0.25 or so, 4, mass enhancement of 4.
Oh, I see.
So, okay, so if this is 4, I think this won't be 3, but rather 2 or so. Yeah?
If I understood correctly, your mutual 3 calculation is done only integrating the density of states of each band separately, right?
Right.
Then what I don't understand is how come you can get an insulator with a partially filled band?
This band, we have 2 electrons here in the band.
But I thought you said that for the EG, you have
1.3/4. No, not 1. 1 + 3/4, and the other one is 1/4, which makes 2 altogether.
Yes, so
sorry, four.
Each
not
one of the bands is partially filled.
Right. Well, we have.
Right.
Yeah. Sure. So what? So then you still have. So if you go to the atomic limit. Also, if this is a calculation where we have, of course, the interaction between the different bands.
There's interaction.
Sure. Okay.
And mu is fixed so that there are exactly two
electrons.
That's
right.
The
you fix you have a single mu for the two bands. Or
sure.
Sure.
This is also the double counter correction will be the same for the two bands.
The lowest temperature calculation that you've done on that insulator is also at 300 Kelvin.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, so actually Jim Allen was first doing also 300 Kelvin calculations, but then with the improved experiment, at least now only the 175 is available.
Jim could go down, but
not this. I asked the same question when he came, and obviously he's frustrated. I'm as frustrated as you are, but he has a question. They prefer to go to low temperature, and they had a little bit of beam time.
So as I understood, they had also a hard time at previously to do the higher temperature calculation with cleavage of the sample, etc. Okay, so thank you.